The Senate Judiciary will come back to order. And we have before us Senator Latz and Senate File 2824. Are you ready? Is you know what? Is Ms. Pondius here? Is she going to be?
She's walking in the door.
Walking in as you speak.
Hi.
Are you going to sit here? Or you want to sit over there? Are you sure? Well, why don't you go sit over there with Senator Latz and Mr. Watson. I think the way we're going to do, members, the way we're going to proceed is that, let's see, Ms. Pontius is going to give us some background information and walk through the legislative history. And then Mr. Watson is going to give us a brief summary about the claims, the work of the Claims Committee to reach to this point. And then Senator Latz is going to go through the bill. And take questions. So why don't both of you come to the table? Unless that's not the order. I was informed that that's what we would be doing. So if things have changed, feel free to uninform me on those facts. Senator Latz?
That is fine. The other option would be, I've got, in addition to the bill itself, I've got some thoughts that that would explain how we came up with the concept that we came up with. And I don't know, perhaps the background is most helpful. I've been through this background so many times now that I forget, so a lot of people haven't seen it. So that might be the best route to go, is to set the table.
If that's okay, I think it would give the members a better context to listen and hear your bill.
That's great.
All right, Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Kathleen Pontius, counsel for the Judiciary Committee. And what I'm going to do is just kind of do an overview of what the potential liability of the state would be under current law or could be under current law with respect to the bridge collapse. And you have two different memos in your packets, I think. There's one that's on, it's an overview of the state law governing tort liability, and in particular some key cases that have dealt with transportation-related functions. And then there's also a legislative history of the caps on tort liability, which is also an important part of the discussion. And basically, you know, if litigation arises out of the bridge collapse, obviously the first issue would be whether there was some fault on the part of the state that contributed to the collapse. And then the next question, if there was some fault attributable to the state, would be whether it would come under a number of statutory exceptions to tort liability that exist in the law. And probably the most likely question would be whether the state was protected from liability under what's called the discretionary duty or discretionary immunity provision of the immunity statute. And then even if there is tort liability found, let's say if the court finds that there is, the jury finds that there is fault and that the court determines that it's not subject to one of the protections of the statute, then it would still be capped under the law, which was in effect at the time of the bridge collapse, so that an individual victim could only recover up to $300,000 in damages, and probably most significantly the total state liability for all claims by all victims would be capped at $1 million. So, you know, with that context in mind, then I thought I'd just go through a brief overview of what the Minnesota law is on state tort liability. You know, under old common law, there is this doctrine called sovereign immunity, which dated back to English common law, basically the concept of you can't sue the king or whatever. And in most states around the country, that same concept existed in tort law, so that government entities weren't subject to tort liability claims. And there were a couple of different decisions of the Minnesota Supreme Court, which are quite a period of time between them. The first one was in 1962, and that case involved a municipal tort liability situation. And the court found that that common law doctrine of sovereign immunity was unjust and archaic and decided that it would no longer recognize it. Then in 1975, using similar reasoning, the court also extended that holding to actions involving the state. And both of these decisions were made prospectives to give the legislature the opportunity to come back and enact a statutory scheme governing tort liability. The court made it clear that, you know, it was still up to the legislature to decide the extent that there would be liability, and also probably most important, that it did not mean by its decision to say that government might not be immune or couldn't be immune in cases involving a discretionary function. And so as a result of these cases, in 1976, the legislature enacted Minnesota Statutes Section 3.736, basically established a general rule that the state is liable for torts committed by its employees and agents, but then subject to a number of specified exceptions in the statute. And the one that's most significant, I think, especially with respect to the bridge collapse situation, is what's called the discretionary duty exclusion. And the statute states that the state is not liable for a loss caused by the performance or failure to perform a discretionary duty, whether or not the discretion is abused. And this is probably one of the most fundamental provisions, both of our state court Tort Claims Act. I think laws around the country, similar doctrine exists under the Federal Tort Claims Act. It's a difficult doctrine to apply, though, in particular cases, and the cases do tend to be very fact-specific in terms of where to draw the line. The basic rule is that a government unit will not be liable for acts that occur at what's more of a planning or policy level or decision-making level, where some element of discretion is involved. But then when you get to what's called more of the ministerial acts, which are at an operational level that don't involve the exercise of discretion, but merely the implementation of established policy and procedures, then there would be liability. And the courts have looked at sort of this basic, what's kind of a basic government duty to balance social, political, and economic considerations in making decisions, and it's that duty that is protected by the discretionary immunity doctrine. There's also a feeling that the judicial branch should not, through the use of tort actions, second-guess policymaking activities that tend to be more legislative or executive in nature. But, you know, at the same time, given the fact that nearly every act involves some exercise of discretion, it is difficult to draw the line in a particular case. Basically, if you're looking at a more higher planning level of decision-making that involves, say, economic decisions, how you're going to spend money, things like that, that would be discretionary immunity. And, you know, because it does really involve a balancing of public policy objectives, but if it's more just a policy's in place and somebody's just out there implementing it, then that would be what's called a ministerial function, and there would be no immunity. As I mentioned earlier, even in cases where you get, say, a plaintiff were get past that threshold and find and that the discretionary immunity doctrine didn't apply, you'd still have to look at the state caps on tort liability. And there have been a couple of cases that have challenged the tort claims caps under both the state and municipal tort claims laws, and the Minnesota Supreme Court has held that the caps are constitutional and that they are rationally related to the legitimate government objective of fiscal stability. And just based on the manifold responsibilities that government engages in, it just has a lot more exposure to potential liability. So the courts in the past have upheld those caps. And they're actually, if you look at the cases, a lot of the cases that do come up in tort law, state liability, are transportation-related types of cases. And just, there's more detailed discussion in the memo that you have, but I'll just sort of highlight a few of the cases just so you can see in particular fact situations when the court did or did not find that discretionary immunity applied. There was a 1988 decision of the Minnesota Supreme Court, it was Nussbaum versus County of Blue Earth, and that involved a decision by an engineer to place a sign ending a slow speed zone before a curve. And the critical inquiry, the court said, was whether the government conduct involved a balancing of policy objectives. And to the extent that action involves the exercise of professional or scientific judgment rather than a policy judgment, then the government may still be liable for the negligence. And the court noted that even though there was some discretion involved in this case in terms of making the decision of where to place the sign, that this was merely a professional judgment, and the state did have a duty to exercise reasonable care in determining whether to authorize a speed zone. So in that case, the action was not protected by discretionary immunity. And then there's another case of interest. Actually, it was a couple of Court of Appeals decisions. In re Alexandria accident of February 8, 1994, that's the case name, was a 1997 Minnesota Court of Appeals decision, which involved a major automobile accident between a Minnesota Department of Transportation snowplow, a van, and a charter bus. There were seven passengers in the van who were killed and others who suffered severe injuries. And the court noted that while discretionary immunity does not protect all decisions, it again emphasized the difficulty under the case law in trying to make a distinction between making versus implementing a policy decision. And whether the consequences of conduct would be immune would depend on whether it involved a balancing of public policy considerations. Now, in that case, the court found that discretionary immunity did apply to, first, a decision to retrofit only newer snowplows with a better lighting system, a decision not to restructure a snowplow schedule, a decision regarding training and supervision of snowplow operators, and also actions in conveying weather forecast information. All of those were protected under the discretionary immunity doctrine. There's also a 1993 Minnesota Court of Appeals case which involved a wrongful death accident that arose out of an accident at a railroad crossing. And the issue was whether the warning devices were adequate. And there the court addressed the state's decision not to upgrade railroad crossings and to delay the repainting of pavement markings. And again, the court found that these decisions were protected by statutory and discretionary immunity, and as a result, there would be no liability on the part of the state. So that just gives you a little bit of a flavor of where the cases have come down. And then I've also included here the legislative history of the caps on state tort liability. When the law was first enacted in 1976, the limit was $100,000 per claimant and $500,000 per occurrence. In 1983, these amounts were increased to $200,000 and $600,000. And then in 1997, there was probably the most significant changes made. And actually, we're in the process of phasing in a series of increases in the caps. In fact, just effective, the $300,000 per claimant and the $750,000 per occurrence became effective in January of 1998, and there was also a delayed increase of $1 million per occurrence that became effective in January 2000. And then, again, in 2006, there were additional increases phased in. The last just took effect on January 1st of this year, and the limitation for a single claimant increased to $400,000. And effective July 1, 2009, it will increase to $500,000. The caps for multiple claims arising out of a single occurrence did increase to $1,200,000 effective January 1st, and it will go up to $1,500,000 effective July 1, 2009. So at the time of the bridge collapse, the caps that were in effect, which would be applicable to these claims, were $300,000 per victim and $1 million per occurrence. And Madam Chair, that's all I have. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Pontius? Senator Foley?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Pontius. I haven't read all of this, not having had access to this, but curious to know what in the bridge, 35W bridge, you're looking at a situation where a number of those folks were working on the job. does that create a problem as to where the source of the funds in the Workers' Comp Act versus one of these categories you're talking about here?
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, they would still be entitled to workers' compensation benefits. Now, I'm in no means an expert of workers' compensation law. I know in certain cases you can go outside of the law, though, if a third party was actually responsible for an injury rather than the employer, you can still go outside of the law to bring an action against the third party.
Senator
Foley?
Madam Chair, is that the current law then that the either would double dip, if you will, the workers' comp in the claim, or would the person be eligible or required for either of those? Because workers' comp, Ms. Pontius, as you know, deals with employer-employee situations, and it by itself is kind of a way of compensating, so it only goes to a certain level.
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, you're right. Workers' comp is kind of a no-fault system, basically. If an injury occurs within the scope of employment, the employee is entitled to workers' comp. But I think the employee still has the option of going, if there's a third party who's actually responsible for something like an injury and a bridge collapse, they would still have the option of going, of bringing a separate suit. Now, the workers' comp benefits might be deducted from any judgment that they obtain, so they wouldn't double dip in that respect. It would be considered a collateral source.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Foley, I believe the answer to that, and I think there are people here who can nod at me if I'm incorrect, but workers' compensation, as Ms. Pontius said, is generally going to pay for things like lost wages and medical bills, much like no-fault will pay. But the difference is that they will generally have a right of subrogation, so they have a right to be repaid from any settlement, unlike the no-fault statute, where they're typically not going to be repaid for those costs. So it isn't a question of this being deducted from the award that they would receive. It's the fact that part of the award would have to go to repay the workers' compensation system for any benefits they provided.
And I think, members, let's wait till we get to the specific bill, and let's raise this specific question about how it actually works in the bill that's in front of us. Mr. Watson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you should have, or for the record, my name is Peter Watson. I'm Senate counsel for the Finance Committee. In your packets, you should have a memo from me titled Compensating Victims of the I-35W Bridge Collapse. And what it does is recites what happened at the three meetings of the Joint House-Senate Subcommittee on Claims that considered what might be done to compensate the victims of the I-35W bridge collapse. And I think Senator Latz in his testimony will probably explain a little bit more how the bill arose out of those meetings. But just to summarize what's in this summary of what happened. At the first meeting, we had presentations from several of the staff people from both the Senate and the House on the history of state tort claims legislation and court decisions, as Ms. Pontius has just relayed to you now. Also, we heard what other states, the other 49 states, had done in the way of state tort claims laws and the kinds of limits that they put on claims in their states. I made a presentation on 9 cases from other states where a bridge had collapsed and what the particular state chose to do by way of compensating victims. In some cases they did, and in other cases they didn't, and the methods and amounts were quite varied. So it gave us something of a feel for what might be done. We also heard from Kenneth Feinberg, who is a special master for the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund that was set up by Congress to provide compensation to those victims. And he gave us advice on what he had learned from going through that process, setting up the process, and actually making and completing the claims. We also heard from various state agency people on what they were currently doing to address the claims that had begun to be filed by the bridge victims. And we heard from the bridge survivors and their attorneys, and also from representatives of the various attorney associations on first what the damages had been done, both physically and psychological, to the people who were on the bridge at the time it fell, and ideas for how those victims should be compensated or not by the state of Minnesota. At the second meeting on November 29th, Senator Latz presented a proposal that he had developed in cooperation with the governor's office for providing for emergency compensation for those people who were in desperate need of current money. And that provided $1 million from current appropriations for tort claims that had not yet been spent, and authorize people to be reimbursed for their lost wages, very much in the manner that people are reimbursed under no-fault auto insurance. There was a limit of $10,000 per claimant, at least temporarily. You take the $10,000 times the approximately 100 people that would be eligible, and that uses up your $1 million. Mm-hmm. But the terms of the agreement with the executive branch were that after some experience, say 30 days, they would take another look and see if the demands on the amount available would permit those limits to go higher. And I believe after some time, they did raise the limits to $20,000 per claimant. I'm not sure if they've done another raise, but last we heard, it was $20,000 per claimant. I led the committee through a list of questions that they needed to answer as they were trying to develop their response to the need for perhaps some kind of compensation. And Ms. Pontius got into the law of subrogation. Mr. Mossman and Helen Roberts gave information about the victims and the damages that were known at that time. We had a list of the personal injuries suffered by people who were on the bridge. The next day, the Department of Administration set up the Emergency Relief Fund and began to accept claims and make payments. At our third meeting, which was January 22nd, the Risk Analysis Division, Tom Chuckle, reported that they had sent out information to everyone that they could identify as having been on the bridge, and that included 171 either survivors or next of kin, and that they had received a total of 121 claims at that time, 88 for bodily damage, 33 for property damage, and they'd paid out about $58,000 from that emergency relief fund to eight claimants, and they had three claims still being processed. We heard from people from Waite House, which is the organization that had the bus full of school children that was on the bridge, telling about the physical and psychological damage that those children had suffered and what Waite House was doing to try to bring them back and address their post-traumatic stress problems. Ms. Pontius explained a law on mental trauma, either accompanied or not accompanied by physical injury, and whether that was eligible for compensation under Minnesota tort law currently, and also the issue of income loss by family caretakers. Representative Ryan Winkler addressed the subcommittee to present his bill, which is a little bit different from the one that's before you in that it creates a generic catastrophe fund for victims of any future catastrophe. It also has an Article 2 that deals with the I-35W bridge collapse and provides compensation for this particular incident. Senator Latz presented his proposal, which really is turned out to be the bill that you have before you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Watson? From the dates and the detail of the information here, it certainly is evident that you all have spent a lot of time and lots of thought into putting together a proposal. that ultimately resulted in a bill that to come before the committee. And you know, on behalf of those of us who didn't get to participate in the process, we want to thank you for your hard work, staff, and yourselves, the Joint House and Senate Committee, and all the people who participated, because I know it was an expedited schedule, and lots of people got together over time and did some very good work. So thank you for all the hard work that you did. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, all of those meetings that were just described took place before the session began. And now is the opportunity for the standing committees to weigh in on the process. I co-chair the Joint House Senate Subcommittee on Claims. We did not have any formal ability to take action with regard to any specific proposal. The outcome of the committee was to raise a lot of questions and try to reach some consensus on key issues to be dealt with. I took what I could from that consensus. As we developed the issues, put them together in a bill and introduced that. And then this is the first standing committee to which that bill has been referred. We all welcome your input, and I welcome the opportunity to present the bill to you. What I'd like to do is to present a little bit of background and some of it sort of the philosophical grounds for the proposal that I'm offering to the committee for consideration, because I think it's important that we put this in context. But let me first say that there are some survivors and family here today. There have been at all the hearings at which I conducted. We've welcomed their input throughout the process as well. And I will say now what I have said in the past, which is that no amount of money that the state offers to pay will ever restore someone to health and bring someone back to life. It's our system of justice. It's what we deal with. It's got its limitations. We have to live within those limitations in this world. The premise of the proposal that you have before you is that we live in a system of laws of general applicability, so that people in the same situations are treated basically the same. Government acts without fear or favor, not arbitrarily, but consistently, so that citizens have confidence that they are getting the same treatment that the last person in the same situation did, and that the next person in the same situation will. If not this system, then government acts are random, arbitrary, rife with favoritism, everyone looking for the exception to the application of the statute, thereby eviscerating the value of the rule of law. This is a question of fundamental government fairness toward all of its citizens. We are making long-term public policy with the proposal that you will consider. Any exceptions that we make to existing law will have long-term precedent. Now, the bridge collapse was indeed unique in some ways. It was unique in the scope, the number of people who died and who were injured in one incident. It was unique in the way it pierced the consciousness of everyone, because it made us conscious of our vulnerability to a risk that we had not really thought of. Driving over a bridge felt more dangerous on August 2nd than it did on July 31st. And most of us drive over bridges every day. Many, myself included, imagined ourselves on the bridge and what it would have been like, though I'm sure we could never really understand unless we had been through it. This collapse also led to massive media coverage throughout the world, the dramatic pictures, the injuries, and the loss of life, and everything that went along with it. Our hearts filled with compassion. But analytically, it is really no different than any other negligence case. The civil lawsuits written by the lawyers for the victims will say the same basic things that any tort claim against the state says: that the state had a duty of care to those who used the bridge, that the state needed to exercise a standard of care in taking care of the bridge, that the state deviated from that standard of care, causing the injuries to the plaintiffs. Now, given the circumstances, the state, in my judgment, does face significant legal exposure.
That said, I also believe that compensating the survivors and the families of the deceased is the right thing to do. However, if we believe in the rule of law and its non-arbitrary application, then we must deliver compensation in a way that does not undermine the premise of the statutes that govern it if we were to take no special action. To completely ignore the current statutory scheme of liability caps for government would be unfair and inequitable to our constituents, to the taxpayers who will foot the bill, to those who were hurt in the past, and to those who will be hurt in the future. For example, a case which everyone is familiar, that of the death of Drew Shadeen. She was killed, arguably, and ultimately alleged at the due to the negligence of the state, in that case not properly supervising or improperly releasing a person that had been in state custody. When Drew Shadeen's survivors brought a claim against the state, the claim was settled at the liability cap then in effect for an individual claim of $300,000. That was in the news last July. So one question which would be raised in terms of fairness or equity would be, how could we tell the family of Drew Shadeen that her life was worth a different amount than the life of those who died on the bridge collapse? Another theoretical example could be that of a state patrol officer. And Senator Foley might understand most clearly this example, given his long service as a state trooper in Minnesota. If a state patrol officer were conducting a high-speed chase, and in the course of that chase happened to injure a pedestrian along the way. Maybe, maybe not as a consequence of negligence. Certainly an allegation from the pedestrian or the pedestrian's family may claim negligence. But a very real possibility. We have high-speed chases in the state on a regular basis, and people do get injured during that time. And a claimant there would be subject to the state tort claims statutes of the individual cap. Currently, that cap, effective January 1, is $400,000, or the aggregate cap of $1,200,000 per occurrence. Every city, county, or school district that might be held to have caused injury also faces the same statutory scheme limiting their liability. To tell them, or the people injured, that they have to live with the caps and only get, say, three or, under current law, $400,000. But if they had been on the bridge and had suffered exactly the same injuries, they would have gotten, say, $2 million, I suggest would be an inequitable approach to state law and compensation. And we should remember that the caps apply to the state, also apply under current statute, under a separate but current statute, to every local government in Minnesota. We are dealing with tens of millions of dollars in a budget under severe pressure this year. In a zero-sum budget, which I think in reality we are dealing with this year, every dollar that goes here does not go into your districts for schools, roads, bridges, local government aid, in which case property taxes make up the difference, early childhood education or programs, the size of the bonding bill that we can afford perhaps as well. How much money we need for this bill will depend in part on the parameters we set for determining the levels of individual compensation. We should remember also that the state will not likely be the only source of compensation. There are several parties who will be claimed to be at fault and who may also end up paying survivors. So we do not need to feel compelled to shoulder 100% of the financial responsibility here. The proposal I'm going to outline to you, I believe, takes a moderate and balanced approach to addressing this very real need. It is a proposal which is supported in concept and in the main parameters by Governor Pawlenty's office. Indeed, the lengthy discussions that were referenced before also included many meetings besides those specifically of the Subcommittee on Claims, of a whole variety of stakeholders in this process, including the governor's office. I would like now to summarize the proposal for you and then to walk through the bill, if I might. The key elements of the proposal are that funds would be appropriated to compensate individuals who were on the bridge at the time of the collapse and suffered injury of the type compensable under existing personal injury tort law. This might include categories such as lost income, medical expense, mental anguish accompanied by physical injury, including as recognized in the tort of the negligent infliction of emotional distress, which is a very limited means of compensation for emotional distress when the claimant is not specifically physically injured. Under the proposal, the $1 million aggregate liability cap does not apply. And my logic for that is that this incident, as I described earlier, is unprecedented in scope in the number of claims arising out of a particular incident, one which I do not believe the legislature would have contemplated when it established the existing caps. And in particular, because the state in this proposal would be taking a special initiative outside of the existing tort law process and essentially setting up a no-fault fund for compensation, lifting the cap for the purpose of handling the matter more expeditiously, more efficiently, expenditure of resources from both the state and potential claimants, and at less distress to the state and, more importantly, to claimants. And more quickly, I think that is those values would support, in this particular case, not applying the $1 million aggregate cap. The individual liability cap in this proposal is established at $400,000, not the $300,000 that was in effect on state law on August 1, 2007. The logic for that is severalfold. One is that but for the passage of about 5 months of time, it would have been $400,000. The cap, individual cap, went up by previous operation of law, as described by Ms. Pontius, to $400,000 per individual on January 1, 2008, for events that occurred after that date. Secondly, this bill includes in it coverage for any liability that might be claimed, or I should say a release would include releasing the University of Minnesota and the City of Minneapolis, which at this time I don't think anyone contemplates that they have done anything which would make them susceptible to liability, but they are taxpayer dollars involved, and we think that also would appropriately support an increase in the individual cap. On that point, the mechanism that we have used within the bill to accomplish that is to retroactively change the statute that established the effective date for the increase from $300,000 to $400,000, making that effective date August 1, 2007. It happens coincidentally that the bridge collapsed on the date that many state laws automatically take effect, we felt this was the most easily applied mechanism for making that change. I should note for the record that I am having a meeting scheduled for Monday with some other stakeholders in issues of liability caps to make sure that there are no unintended consequences arising from this particular mechanism that we've chosen to raise that cap. One thing that is important, I think, to factor in that is that the state does have greater fiscal capacity and thus more fiscal stability and ability to absorb a larger individual claim than local governments or municipalities would have, just because our budget is so much bigger, whereas an individual claim of $300,000 or $400,000 could have a much more dramatic impact on the budget of a city the size of, for example, St. Louis Park, that I know best, than it would on the state government's budget. The mechanism for administering this fund would be a third-party administrator separate from the Department of Administration and separate from the legislature. The bill proposes that the third-party administrator would be a panel of three special masters, all three of whom would be attorneys, of which at least one must be a retired judge. And the attorney or the panel would be appointed by the Chief Justice of the state of Minnesota. And I've had conversations with the Chief Justice and with the state court administrator, Sue DeSalle, about the mechanism that would be involved here. And they are in the process of trying to flesh out that particular mechanism. Persons accepting compensation from this fund would waive any and all claims against the state of Minnesota, the University of Minnesota, and the city of Minneapolis for damages arising out of the bridge collapse, and would cooperate with the state in pursuing any claims the state may have against any other parties. Persons who choose to not accept compensation from this fund would be subject to all limitation on the state's tort liability in effect at the time of the bridge collapse. They simply revert to the law that was in effect as anyone else would have at the time of the collapse. Funds paid out to persons out of the Emergency Hardship Fund would be deducted from an award out of the Final Bridge Compensation Fund. The state would retain its right to recover from any other tortfeasor payments made from the Bridge Compensation Fund. Existing statutes relating to collateral source offsets for tort settlements with the state of Minnesota would apply. And the amount of the appropriation is yet to be determined. We have requested a fiscal note. We are awaiting a response from the Department of Finance on that. And there's a lot of information to collect. We have been gathering information over the last 6 months, but there may be certain limitations on the amount of information that we can get ahead of time in terms of what the exact extent of medical injuries, of wage losses, and other damages that might be claimed, and as well as information relating to other sources of compensation that would implicate collateral source offset. So there will be limitations on how precise the ultimate fiscal note can be in this case. It is stated in the bill that it's the intent of the legislature to fully compensate the claims that are made within the guidelines set forth for the administration of this fund. We would probably end up overshooting a little bit in the appropriation, but in the event that it turns out to be not enough, our intent would be to come back to supplement that at a later time by subsequent legislative action. I know that's a discussion better suited for a later time in front of the Finance Committee, but that's the nuts and bolts, or the basic outline of the proposal that you have before you. If you like, Madam Chair, I could turn now to the specifics of the bill, or I could entertain questions at this point before I move forward.
Senator Latz, I understand that there is an author's amendment to put the bill into the shape that you want us to consider it.
There is.
And that, members, would be, I believe, the A2 amendment that you have in your packets.
I'd move that.
Senator Scheid moves the A2 amendment, which is the author's amendment, to put the bill in the shape that he would like to be in. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Latz, would you like to point out the amendment? Did you, in going through the bill, incorporated the differences in the amendment? Why don't you walk us through the amendment a little bit, the changes you made?
It might be easier, Madam Chair, if I walk through the bill and then
yes.
Identify the portions of the bill that are...
Excellent. Very good.
Madam Chair and members, the first article in the bill, Article 1, entitled State Tort Claims, is the portion of the bill that retroactively amends the state tort claims liability cap for individual claimants, both for wrongful death claims and for injury claims, making that effective August 1, 2007, instead of January 1, 2008. That's Section 1, the Subdivision 4, and that goes on to page 2. You note the effective date is an effective retroactively from August 1, 2007. Article 2 of the bill is the specific terms relating to the I-35W bridge collapse. Section 1 establishes findings or deals with the compensation for victims of the I-35W bridge collapse. The first subdivision deals with legislative findings that we thought were appropriate to recognize the specific nature of this particular event. It sets forth the uniqueness of this particular catastrophe in paragraph subdivision 1, paragraph A. In paragraph B, it distinguishes two things. It distinguishes the normal method by which the state deals with natural disasters, of which this is not one. And it also identifies the grounds for setting up this special process rather than leaving it solely to the regular route of tort claims against the state. The amendment in this case does amend line 2.27 after the period, deletes everything from the period beginning with the word words in addition through the end of that paragraph. Paragraph C further explains the grounds for establishing an alternative compensation process for the victims as to why it furthers the public interest, providing a remedy for victims while avoiding the uncertainty of a potentially complex and protracted litigation to resolve the issue of liability of the state and its employees for damages incurred by victims. If individuals were to go through the regular tort system, they'd have to establish liability first off and then establish the amount of damages. Given the nature of this event and the complexity of these kinds of claims, that could be a 3 to 5 year process. It's anticipated in this bill that most claims, if not all claims, will be paid out within a year from the date that the fund is established, without need to determine liability specifically, let alone resort to litigation. That also avoids some burdens on the state court system that would result from this kind of complex litigation. On page 3, subdivision 2 sets forth the definitions. Paragraph A establishes the damages as basically within the existing confines of tort law in Minnesota. Paragraph B identifies the emergency relief fund that was established by the governor in November of 2007. Municipality is defined as well. The panel refers to the special master panel, which is later created. The state is self-explanatory. And the definition of victim identifies a natural person who was present on the bridge at the time of the collapse. So we're dealing here with people, not with businesses. We're dealing with people on the bridge, not those who were beside the bridge or before they got on the bridge or just crossed the bridge. These are only people who are on the bridge. And, of course, they're legal representatives in the appropriate cases. Subdivision 3 sets up the special master panel and the appointment process that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court would establish the panel. One reason for having the Chief Justice involved in this is that it removes the process from the political institutions in the state of Minnesota. In my judgment, would help to establish the credibility and the acceptability among the public as well as among the victims of the final compensation decisions that are made, the offers of settlement that are made to the claimants. All of the three panel members would have to be attorneys, at least one of whom must be a retired judge, and the retired judge would be the chair of the panel. All of the members of the panel would have to have had experience in the legal issues relating to the types of claims which will be coming in, the tort claims. The Chief Justice will determine the pay and expenses to be received by a member of the panel. Now, there are some who have suggested that we should seek people to volunteer for these positions. In my judgment, I think if we're asking professionals to do a professional job, it's fair to compensate them for their services. I think that also enhances the accountability in the process as well. We pay for services, we expect results. With all of these pieces in place, I'm confident that we would have an accountable, reliable, and credible process for making compensation determinations.
Senator Latz, it just struck me the way that the wording is on line 3.23, a member of the panel. Is that a term of art, or because I'm looking at that and I've often joked to this committee that English is my second language, but it looks like it's either going to be by the members of the panel or by each member of the panel. I don't know what's contemplated in terms of payment here.
Madam Chair, I'll defer to the staff that drafted that provision. I see what you're saying, perhaps.
The teachers in the room. I think it should.
Maybe the person, the people who drafted it or not in the room, I would agree with you that perhaps each member of the panel might be a better term than a member of the panel.
Is that, Senator Latz, because my understanding is that you're not contemplating that different members in the panels be compensated differently.
That's correct.
Right. So they would be.
Just strike members, a member of.
Just members.
Strike a member of.
Or just by the panel. Anyway, she's asking.
Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, I think if you just struck on page 3, line 23, just strike a member of, then the Chief Justice determines the pay and expenses to be received by the panel. And, you know, if somebody is from out of town and has to drive in, I mean, there may be mileage expenses. They can differ, but I think that that's just let them figure it out. But, you know, I think that cleans it up a little bit.
Senator Betzel moves that on line 3.23, delete a member of. Any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, while we're still on this page, if we could go back up to the definition section and victim. It may be just the hour and I'm, but you know, line 3.10, victim means a natural person who was present. Victim includes the parent or legal guardian, surviving spouse, etc. They seem to conflict with each other. I mean, and I'm just wondering, I don't know if you would, because a victim may or may not have survived. I understand that. And I also understand that survivors, whether they were on the bridge or not, are victims. But I think it's a little confusing there. I don't know. It seems vague to me. And I certainly don't quarrel with what I know you're trying to accomplish there, but I'm wondering if there were a more artful way to say it. You?
And Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins.
I agree. I think that, you know, a sentence that says a victim includes the parent or legal guardian of a victim. You know, that's a sentence that needs some editing.
Say also includes. I have like this all the time.
And so maybe somebody can work on that while we're continuing to discuss the bill. But
we'll put a big asterisk here, Senator Higgins and Senator Scheid, and let's we'll revisit this.
Okay, Madam Chair. Right, because I don't have anything to suggest right now, right. But I'm just wondering if it caught anybody else's attention.
Right. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wonder if on line 3.11, if you, the second time victim is used, if it should also be an asterisk so that we know we're talking about our use of that word from this point forward. And then after that reference, if we just included the word also between victim and includes, victim also includes.
Yeah, I thought that
helps, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
I wondered if that would work. It sounds better, Madam Chair. So I'm not sure I understood exactly the first part of what Senator Olson said, but I like the also after victim on line, the first victim on 3.11, right? And put also.
So victim, comma?
No.
No. Just also.
Insert also.
But insert also.
But Madam Chair, I think we should also have asterisks around that victim at the beginning of that sentence. Since we have it the first time, so we kind of need to have it the second if we're talking about how it's.
I believe that's a reviser style, Senator Olson. They've stopped doing that, but
yeah, it's still badly written. So,
well, Senator Higgins.
Yep, I know. I have my notebook.
Ruminate on it.
Yeah,
and we'll come back.
Madam Chair,
that's a big word, Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, I'd like to have you look at page 6 and line 6-3. Line 6, 9, and 10, line 6.15, and delete all of those, notwithstanding any statutory or common law agreement to the contrary. And
Senator Foley, can you hang on to that? And because we sort of put the brake on Senator Latz right here because of my question. Hang on to that, and I'm going to let him continue walking us through the rest of the bill until we get to that point, and then please ask me to call on you again. Senator Latz, can you pick us up where you left us?
Sure.
On page 3. I think you were just...
was that line 3.24, Madam
yes.
Chair? Going to subdivision 3, paragraph B. This paragraph... indicates that the state court administrator will be the basically the manager of the process at the top of the administrative process. They would hire the employees necessary to assist the panel in doing its work, establishes those employees in the unclassified state civil service. It indicates that current employees of the state or consultants of the state can be used to help the panel in processing the claims, and that the funding for that would come out of the appropriation that's contained in this bill. So it is intended to hold the state court administrator harmless and so that they do not incur any fiscal responsibility for administering this. That will all be shouldered within the confines of this fund.
And Senator Latz, I'm assuming that the expenditure, the appropriation in the bill will also cover the expenses for the panel members that we talked about previously?
That is the intent, yes.
Okay. Please continue.
Although, let's see here.
And these should just be damn comments.
Your question.
Ones.
Raised my mind whether or not we have any language that specifically provides for that. I think we might want to look to make sure we do include language that specifically provides for that.
I see. On page 7, line 10.
Okay.
Very good.
So we're covered. Paragraph C provides for the panel to adopt their procedures, rules, and forms for considering the claims and for making offers of settlement and entering into settlement agreements. The author's amendment, A2, deletes the end of line 3.30, starting with the word these, and through the end of that paragraph. The reason for that is it's picked up a little bit later in the amendment, but it... the judicial branch has its own specific rules for dealing with these kinds of questions, and it avoids a separation of powers question, trying to hold the judicial branch's proceedings internally to executive branch rules or laws. That was at the suggestion of the state courts. Paragraph D provides that the state court administrator will forward the documentation of all these salaries and expenses relating to this matter to the Commissioner of Finance for the actual payment of the amounts. And that's the same process for paying any settlements which are accepted by claimants. Paragraph E provides for absolute immunity for the members of the panel and their employees and contractors acting under their direction. So as long as their conduct is within the scope of performing their duties under this section. Subdivision 4 sets out the parameters under which the claims will be considered, offered for settlement, and paid. The panel shall, in fact, consider the claims, make offers of settlement, enter into settlement agreements with victims as provided in this section. The victim must have filed a claim with the panel within 6 months of the effective date of this section in order to qualify for these funds. That 6 months date will occur more than 1 year after the incident date, more than 1 year after August 1. In typical tort claims, you need at least a year to pass before you'll be able to get even medical opinions on permanency of injuries. Our thought was that past the one-year anniversary date, claimants would be in a better position, and their attorneys, where they are represented, would be in a better position to make long-term damages claims. Is something which we've had some discussions about, whether or not there ought to be some flexibility within the panel to have the ability for good cause to extend that deadline as well. There's no provision in this bill right now for that, but that question has arisen, particularly given that it will take some time for the panel to ramp up and create the forms and get everything put into place.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this is really the first chance that I've had to thank you too, Senator Latz, for the hard work that you've done on this bill. I know it's a very difficult position to be in, trying to balance the law of the state and fairness to taxpayers in the light of this kind of a tragedy and dealing with victims of this magnitude when, as you said, no amount of money ever really makes up to them for what they've been through. So having done this in private practice for many years before coming to the Senate, I can I just really commend you for the work that you've done and how difficult I know it must be. That being said, I have a question about this that I agree with you that sometimes it takes more than a year to know really what the extent of your damages may be, and actually that's probably the case in many or most cases where there have been quite serious injuries. But I'm also looking at this, and the way I'm reading it, unless there's something else in here that would address this differently, let's just say someone is ready to make their claim right now, right after this is passed, and they make their claim within a month of the time we pass this legislation. It looks to me as though you would then have another 11 months before a settlement offer would necessarily be due in response. And am I reading that wrong? Because normally under state law, we'd expect a response within 30 days from the time that a claim was made, some kind of a response to that claim. Is there anything that requires there to be a counteroffer or a response to a settlement offer within a certain period of time?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, there's two questions in there.
Okay.
One is, what if someone makes a claim immediately? What you're looking at, you should look at the next sentence after the one we were talking about with the six-month deadline for making a claim. The next sentence says, any offer of settlement must be made by the panel within 1 year after the effective date of this section. So we're trying to set a closure date for the panel's offers of settlement. There's nothing in this that precludes the panel from accepting claims as soon as they can get up and running and making offers of settlement as soon as they can make that determination.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Latz, I understand that that's a closure date, but I guess what I'm wondering is there also something in here that would require a response within a certain period of time? You have an outside limit, but which would seem to be kind of 6 months to contemplate this for those claims that came in at the last minute, but assuming some will come in earlier, is there a reason that we should be waiting 6 months for a response to come back, or do you think that's reasonable?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson.
Not me.
I can't sit here today and tell you how long it will take. Once this bill becomes effective in law, for the State Court Administrator and the Chief Justice to select and appoint the panel members, to hire the staff, to establish the forms and procedures for, and to make available all of this information to potential claimants, and then to receive the claims. I can't tell you what the administrative ramp-up time is. I also, right now, cannot forecast the complexity of any particular claims. And it may be that the panel might want to wait until they receive a certain number of claims to get some idea of what they're seeing before they make any decisions. It may be they're in a position to make an offer of settlement very quickly. I'm not comfortable requiring the panel to make an offer of settlement within, say, 30 days of receiving a claim, especially, let's say, the claim comes in 2 weeks after the bill becomes effective, and the panel wouldn't even have a chance hardly to get together and talk about that, to set up all their procedures. There will be some ramp-up time. I can't predict that. This entire process is telescoped immensely compared to the ordinary state tort claims process. I think the intent here, and it would be quite clear, the legislative intent is to move this process forward as expeditiously as possible. I'm reluctant to put into state law a specific deadline in that regard.
Well, Senator Latz, I appreciate the fact that in the previous section, when you talked about it, you have indicated that the panel will come up with their own procedures and how they do that. I'm assuming that would be part of the discussion, the kind of the timing and the sequencing of this. But I just want to make sure I heard you correctly, that what is intended by the second sentence at line 4.8 and 4.9 is that 1 year after the effective date of this section is the absolute last date that the panel could make any offer. So, in essence, 1 year after the effective date of this section, all the work of the panel has to be completed, and there will not be any other offers made after that date. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. That's what's in the language. One thing to note is that 1 year date will occur while the legislature is still in session in 2009. So if the panel finds for some reason that it's unable to complete its work despite its best efforts before that deadline, they could make a request to the legislature, and we would have an opportunity to act to extend that deadline if we felt it was appropriate to do so. But, yes, the goal is to get everything done and wrapped up within 1 year of when this legislation would take effect.
And, Senator Latz, I appreciate the thought you've given to sort of the time process and the one deadline, and the effective date is immediate upon enactment, so kind of thinking ahead, but is the 1 year time window enough to process all the settlement, all the cases?
Well, we're trying to project into the future. It's difficult to know. There were, most accounts, about 187 people on the bridge at the time of the collapse. Various accounts, there were anywhere from 100 to 145 or so injuries, including 13 deaths. So we're not dealing with 3,000 or 4,000 settlement offers or 10 or 12,000 claims like were made in the 9/11 situation. That did take several years and several hundred million dollars in administrative expenses. We're not looking at anywhere near in that scope. My own sense is that a year should be enough. It would keep the panel focused on attempting to meet that deadline. But as I say, if they find, despite the best efforts, that it's not enough time to complete the job properly, they would have an opportunity to come back to the legislature. If we set the deadline, say, in June of 2009, and they get to the end of May 2009 and realize they can't wrap it up in the next 30 days, We're going to be out of session by that time. So at least with the deadline while we're in session, it gives us an opportunity to revisit.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Thank you. While we're kind of dwelling on this particular section, I do have a thought on the idea that the victim must file a claim with the panel within 6 months after the effective date of the section. The effective date is the day after the governor signs the bill, which is whatever date that falls. I think we sort of expect that the 2008 legislative session is, I would guess, probably going to end sometime in April. And if it's presented to the governor around that time period, that puts it 6 months out, maybe mid-late October. I think it would make a little bit more sense if we had a date certain in the bill, like the victim must file the claim with the panel by, say, December 31st, 2008. And then if there's 1 year to process the claims, then they've got until December 31st, 2009, which, you know, is going to be shortly before the next legislative session. But I think rather than rely upon just an arbitrary date of the governor, this gives a little bit extra time to file the claims, but it also puts right there into the law what the date is, so there's no confusion. Nobody's going to miss it because they didn't calculate when the governor signed the bill.
Senator Latz, any thoughts on that suggestion?
Well, Madam Chair, that would add about a whole year to the process. The legislative schedule, anyway, was contemplated to move this, if possible, through the legislature to the governor before a spring recess of this session. I would anticipate, I don't know if we're actually going to be able to meet that deadline, but that was the joint agreement of the leadership in the House and the Senate, as a goal anyway, was to accomplish that. If we were to move, so I would anticipate by April 2009 under this current bill that the entire process would be resolved. If we were to set a deadline December 2009, that adds at least another 8-9 months to the process. Part of the advantage to being involved here is to keep everyone moving and focused as expeditiously as possible. But we're all kind of trying to project into the future here without having a perfect crystal ball on that.
Well, and Madam
Senator
Chair,
Betzel.
Senator Latz, I was just thinking it would be a fairly short time period. I didn't know when you were planning on bringing the bill up, but I think that maybe as we get closer towards a vote on this, and I suspect this is going to have to go to a conference committee because there's going to be differences, I would assume, between the House and the Senate version. We just may want to consider putting an actual date in here when the claims must be filed for rather than 6 months after the effective date, which then people are going to have to go back and research and figure out when did the governor sign it, what was the next day, are we within the time period. If the law says this is the date, then that's the date, and then the panel has 1 year after that to process the claims. And I think that still meets the intent that you have here. We may add a couple of days here or shorten it up, but I think that at least I'd like to see an actual date in there, but we don't need to do that right now.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I agree with Senator Betzel that I think a real date would be useful, especially for the average person who's trying to do the right thing here. Because, heck, I can never remember when effective dates are. But we could do something like October 1st, must file a claim by October 1st, and then the settlement must be offered by May 1st or April 1st or something like that, Senator Latz. I think Senator Betzel put some long times in there, but going by the approximate dates that you've got in here, you could put a real date in there. And then the other thing that I was concerned about is the sentence saying that the offer must be made by, either May 1st or something or within a year. And I think I'm the only not lawyer on the panel right now, but I'm worried about whether people who may be in real financial straits who are counting on this money to help them pay their house payments and get what will be huge bills in many cases paid off, without lots of penalties and charges, and I'm wondering whether there isn't a way we could put in there that the the offer must be made as soon as possible, practical, feasible, pick a word, but, you know, at least by May 1st or some date. I don't want there to be a situation where all the offers or most of the offers aren't made until almost a year has passed. And so that's a suggestion for you. I don't have any way to actually write that, but...
Well,
Senator Betzel,
I'm
on
sure
this
I've
point.
Got a kind of follow-up question that goes in that, because I'm not quite sure what the claim is going to entail. I suspect there may be some victims that are still going to have ongoing costs and medical issues and so forth, and so, you know, forcing the panel to make a settlement offer too early might not be in the victim's interests. They may have to, because then they're, do I take this or whereas, you know, if you just say I've got a claim and I'll get back to you later on, you know, what, you know, how much, you know, I'm looking for, you know, I think that you know, time may be necessary for some of the individuals, maybe not all, but some may need that. So,
Senator Olson,
thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe the first question before I comment along the same lines. And I don't know, Senator Lotz, if you were going to get to explaining this better, but the way I'm looking at this, just scanning it, it seems as though it's not contemplating that typical kind of negotiation process of back and forth, you know, make a settlement demand, and then there's a counter, and then the offers go back and forth. This seems to be that a person's making a claim, and then there's as if there's only one going to be one offer of settlement made in response. And I'm just wondering if first, before we talk about how the time frame of this would work, if you could maybe give us a little explanation of what's contemplated there. Is there going to be some, is it contemplated that there will be some negotiation? Or is this more like an arbitration where a claim is presented and this panel just makes its decision in terms of what the offer will be?
Senator Lotz.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I don't think that the bill specifically speaks to that question. I think it leaves it open and subject to the judgment of the panel. It says they'll make an offer of settlement. It doesn't specify that it's a take-it-or-leave-it offer. That they can't continue to have discussions or have any discussions at all with the claimant or the claimant's representatives. It just doesn't go into that level of specifics. And so I don't think the bill says they can't. I don't think it says that they must. I think it's appropriate for us to leave that level of specifics open to the judgment of the panel. One of the reasons to have a panel that has the kind of experience and credibility that we're contemplating is that there'll be some confidence that they can establish that level of detail in the procedures that would accomplish the purposes set forth in the statute and in the settlement process.
And Senator Olson, on page 3, line 3.29, numeral C, it says the panel may adopt procedures, rules, and forms for considering claims, making offers of settlement, and entering the settlement agreements. So I think that what I'm assuming that that's where the panel and the panel members will be developing the procedures that you're referring to. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, under those circumstances, then it seems to me that we ought to contemplate that there will be some negotiation and some opportunity for that to occur. This won't be just like an arbitration. And in that case, I would think, as some of the other members have stated, that if we're looking to have an idea how many claims are going to be coming in, but some may not be ready to be fully developed, usually at the time you make a claim, unless we're just talking about giving notice of claim, so if we have to give notice of claim within a certain period of time, that would give an idea of what the claims are going to be. Or how many claims they're going to be, but if we're talking about not enough medical information being known or for these claims not to be fully developed, usually you need to have that information if you're going to have to make a complete claim when you make it. And so the fact that there's more time for this to be looked at by the panel doesn't really help so much if you're having to have that information when you have to present your claim.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latch.
Senator Olson, I think that one of the goals here is to expedite and streamline the process. And if we were to allow 2 years and set a notice of claim deadline, which frankly has already passed under state law for claims arising out of the bridge collapse, and then set forth other internal deadlines and stretch this whole thing out over 2 years, it defeats part of the purpose for setting up this fund, which is not only to expedite compensation to the victims, but also to expedite resolving the state's obligations promptly as well. It will also result in greater administrative expenses as employees, staff, panel members are working an extra however long it will be, the longer the timeline is. So to keep administrative expenses down is also an incentive for having a more expedited process. I don't know if the panel is going to want to set up a notice of claim or not. I don't think I would want to tie their hands to that particular procedure. At some point, you've got to draw the line, and this happens in every case. Sometimes it's when the judge establishes the scheduling order for a case. We're going to trial on such and such a date, and you're going to have your act together by then, and whatever you know at that time is what you're going to present to the jury. And that's where it ends. Someone's going to have to draw a line here, and no one's ever going to know for darn certain exactly what the precise dollars and cents are going to look like. All we can do is to try to do the best. One of the advantages of setting up the process this way, as compared to, for example, the House, which doesn't have some of the same parameters, but which will be setting an overall appropriation, is that within the House's plan, they're basically going to have to receive all of the claims, put a basic dollar amount or value to each of the claims, then figure out if that fits within the appropriation that's been established. And if it doesn't, they're going to have to make proportional reductions or judgments in each of the claims to figure out who's going to get how much of an offer. In that case, you actually could end up with claimants competing against each other for the dollars that are involved. The contemplation here is that within the limit set under the individual cap, is that there are going to be, the claims will come in, they'll get as much information as they can, and you can do it like a rolling admissions process at a university. As the information is complete, decisions can be made, payments can be made. You don't have to wait for everything to come in. So this would actually expedite and keep the process moving forward, the manner in which we've put this process together. But the level of detail that we put in, it might turn out not to be an appropriate detail, and I think we want to leave the panel to have a certain amount of discretion to do what they think is the best way to handle the claims.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Latz, what is going to, you know, you've got this panel, and they're going to make some offers and then ultimately settle if it falls in. But where do you see them going from the time they get in until the time that some award is offered? Do you expect that most of the settlements will be close to the cap, or is it going to be spread back and used for other purposes, maybe the injury or something else is greater in their judgment? I'm not sure what they're being compensated for. Do you have any idea as to what will happen in that process?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, I don't expect that that most of the claims will be at or near the cap. There are some people who suffered very serious injuries and will have medical expenses alone that would be more than the cap amount. There are others that were fortunate enough not to suffer much in the way of injuries at all. For those cases, their medical expenses might be quite minimal. Their wage loss would be much less. Their level of emotional distress would be less as well. So I think you will find a full range of the injuries out of this incident, just as you do in the full range of ordinary tort claims. They will include claims for medical expenses, for wage loss, past and future.
for mental anguish or pain and suffering, and there may be some other narrower categories of losses as well. Some of those are easy to put dollar figures to. Some of them are not. And that's one thing which this proposal would leave to the discretion of the panel, is to perhaps set some guidelines as to how they're going to handle those various categories of tort claim damages. For the ones that exceed the cap in damages, their compensation will be at the cap. But we should also understand that the actual amount of compensation is going to be determined after deductions are made for collateral sources per existing state law. Anytime the state is a defendant in a claim, they contemplate making a settlement or to go to a jury verdict by operation of law, deductions are made for collateral sources, other sources of payment to the victim. And then whatever is left is something if that the state would be then in a position to pay.
Senator Latz, why don't you walk us through that section right now on page 4? I think that's where you're at.
That is next. Yeah, you're right. On page 4, starting at line 4.10, paragraph B, it details the mechanism for establishing the settlement offer. The total damages incurred by the victim, less or minus a collateral source reduction, calculated under MnSTAT section 548.36. That is the standard calculation that's done for state tort claims. Also subtracting any payment made to the victim from the emergency relief fund. So there will be some victims that will have received maybe $20,000 in wage loss payments from the emergency relief fund. In a sense, they've received that as an advance on whatever settlement is offered here. And so that advance would be deducted. And that actually, there's a statute that provides for that. It was suggested to us by the incoming president of the State Bar Association, who testified last at one of our subcommittee on claims hearings, who pointed out that statute to us and notified us of that mechanism for making these kind of advance settlement payments. The other deduction would be any payments made or required to be made to the victim by a third-party tortfeasor under the terms of either an existing settlement or other agreement with the victim or final judgment. So if, for example, let's say theoretically the contractor on the bridge were to have already made a settlement with the victim, then the state would deduct from what the state pays to the victim the amount of that payment as well. On the other end of that, if the chronology is different, if the state settles first and then there is later a claim by the victim separately against, say, the contractor, if they make a recovery, the state will have some ability to get its portion of that recovery as well. So those are the deductions that would be applied to whatever the total damages are determined to be for each victim.
Okay. On that section, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on that issue, and you referenced a later section you're going to be talking about, too, that talks about the state's right to recovery. And that raises a question I have in terms of order of priority. Because when you talk about a deduction, I understand that you don't want to duplicate payment for the same thing, and that makes sense. But let's think about somebody who has, say, $1 million worth of damages that whose damages are going to exceed that $400,000 cap. Are you saying that if they had received a payment that that would reduce the $400,000 cap that they would be entitled to, or only that you would deduct that from the $1 million worth of damages they might otherwise prove, and as long as they can prove $400,000 worth, they'd still get that $400,000?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, as I understand the operation of law, you would deduct the other payments from the $1 million,
okay.
And if there was still left $400,000 worth of uncompensated damages to the victim, then the state would pay the $400,000.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought that's probably what you intended. And so in under those circumstances, when you have that corresponding statute that talks about the state's right of subrogation, I think under existing law, unless you added the language that the person had a right to be made whole or that the state didn't have a first priority right of subrogation, which is usually what it would be considered, that then not only are you going to be taking away from people who won't be made whole, but they would end up with a different amount of money depending on the order of settlement. So that if they settled first, I mean, if they have a large amount of damages, let's say in the amount of $1 million. So I guess I would just suggest that the language, when we get to that part, we should think about order of priority and making sure that people are made whole before the state is repaid.
Senator Latz, please proceed.
Thank you. Lines 19 through 22 set forth the specific parameters for these claims amounts. It establishes the $400,000 as the cap per individual claimant, and then it also establishes that the $1 million aggregate cap that was in effect at the time of the law does not apply to this process. We've talked about that before. Paragraph C is a little more detailed in the way it establishes some procedures. The agreement must be in writing for an offer of settlement must be made appropriately. Someone who accepts an offer of settlement must agree in writing to release the state and every municipality of this state and their employees from liability for damages, and also agreeing in writing to cooperate with the state in pursuing the claims the state may have against any other party. The release will also provide that the victim will indemnify the state for any claim of contribution or indemnity or both made by other persons against the state, and the release will satisfy any judgment obtained by the victim in an action against others to the extent of the release if the claim relates to the bridge collapse. And then the release also would provide for the subrogation interest of the state. And I don't know if by operation of standard law there's a specific order of priority. I know with regard to the deductions, that's the standard order is the way I described it.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know with respect to other situations where there are subrogation rights, typically there will be that issue should be addressed because we have some insurance policies where we require that a victim is made whole before there can be a right of subrogation, and we have other situations, especially involving the government, where they take their money first. And if let's say someone has $1 million worth of damages and they receive $400,000 from the state and all that's available is, say, an additional $200,000 from somewhere else, I think it's important that additional $200,000 goes to the victim if they still have damages up to that amount. It doesn't go to repay the state so that the person, in effect, loses the value of that additional settlement. And I think it would be important to clarify that.
Senator Latz, I understood the opposite. I thought that the bill does intend to make them whole. I guess. Can you clarify? Let's see. Senator Olson, are you saying that specific language has to be inserted after line 4.33?
Madam Chair, I can clarify something that might help inform this discussion. I might need to ask for some guidance from Senate Counsel on this as well. Here we get into a difference, at least in part, between state-regulated insurance plans and ERISA plans, right, which are regulated by the federal government. Under state-regulated insurance plans, there are no... the insurance plans don't get to assert their rights to recover payments until after the victim has been fully compensated for their damages. So if they hit a cap on state compensation and they didn't get fully compensated for all of their losses, medical, wage, pain and suffering, everything, then the state, then their insurance company, if it's a state-regulated plan, would not be able to seek their recovery rights yet until they perhaps recovered from a third-party tortfeasor and made up the gap there. If it's an ERISA plan, it's federal law. And frankly, I think there's very little that we can do, although we are going to try to deal with that. But under federal law, they have a right, those plans, either a self-insured a plan or an insurance company that's governed, a plan that's governed by ERISA, they have a right to recover their payments before the victim receives full compensation for their losses. So first dollar in, first dollar out is the way that would normally operate. The language is drafted in this bill to try to protect the victims as much as possible from facing that scenario under the ERISA plans. But there's only so much that we can do. I think at some point, insurance companies or ERISA plans will have to understand what I think would be pretty negative public relations to attempt to make those recoveries, to bring a claim or to bring a lawsuit against one of these victims to try to recover their share. But all we can do, I think, is to try to place it in as strong a legal position as possible. But ultimately, federal law and probably a court's interpretation of that will have to come.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Latz. And I'm aware of the difference between an ERISA policy and a private insurance policy, as you described. I think a private insurance policy, there's language in the Fair Claims Practices Act that talks about the victim's right to be made whole before there's third-party subrogation interests that have to be satisfied. And I think it's important that some language to that effect be incorporated here, because this isn't a private insurance. And there are other kind of intermediary situations where the government has made medical payments, like, say, through MA or through Minnesota Care, Medicaid. And there's a body of law related to that that talks about the state's right to share kind of on a pro rata basis in the claim. And that's an oversimplification of my understanding of the law, but it does give them some rights of recovery even when the victim hasn't been made whole. And so since this is going to be a government fund, if we want to make sure that it's clear that it is our intent to take a secondary position or a back seat in comparison to the victim, making sure that they have the first right to be made whole, I think it's important to put that language in here.
I think Ms. Pontius has some information that could help clarify the conversation. Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think the language that you're referring to is in 62A.095, which regulates subrogation clauses in state plans or state-regulated plans. And there is a sentence in there that says, with respect to a subrogation clause, it has to provide that it applies only after the covered person has received a full recovery from another source. Mm-hmm. I think that's what you're referring to.
That's correct, Madam Chair and Ms. Pontius. That is the law that would apply to a state-regulated plan, but it isn't the law that necessarily applies to the state's subrogation interests in all cases. And so that's why I think that clarification is important.
Ms. Pontius, do we have that anywhere in the bill that's before us? That reference to that or that clarification?
Madam Chair, not with respect to the state's subrogation interest.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I'm listening carefully to what Senator Olson is saying, and I agree with her. And I may have gotten myself confused by reading it too many times, but I think you're maintaining the state's right to subrogation here. Am I correct? That's Senator Olson's concern, and it would be mine as well, that it not happen until people are made, after people are made whole. So am I reading that correctly? This is protecting the state's right here.
Right.
Senator Latz, are you attempting to protect the state's rights here?
Chair, yes.
I think that Senator Olson raises a good point.
Do you want to try to fix this tonight, or do you want to work with Senator Latz? Because he has to go to Senator Scheid's committee, I believe.
Madam Chair.
For this purpose. So.
Madam Chair, it would be on the issue of subrogation as it pertains, I think, to, well, subrogation in general, but as it pertained to insurance, I thought. But anyway, but that certainly fits here.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Senator Latz, if it's all right with you, I'd be happy to talk to you because I think your intent is clearly the same as what I'm my concern, and I just think it would be a good idea to insert language along the lines of the same language that applies to health plans to make sure that, or state-regulated health plans to make sure that there isn't any question about that issue in this bill.
Senator Latz?
I'm fine with that.
All right. Let's move on to, I think that we get the Subdivision 7, the election to proceed in district court if they choose not to participate in this process. Can you move us quickly through Section 2 and the rest of the bill? And I believe Senator Foley has a comment he wants to make, the rest of the bill.
Is there a place you want me to skip to, Madam Chair?
Section 2, page 5, line 5.23, because I think the rest of the items leading up to that is self-explanatory. So do you want to just quickly walk us through Section 2 on page 5? Section 2, yeah. Subdivision 1, and Subdivision 2.
On Section 2, Subdivision 1, basically establishes that the state is not admitting any liability in this process. This whole process here is for the purpose of accomplishing the compensation under the parameters that are established before that. It doesn't establish any duty of anyone to compensate the victims. And anything done here is not admissible in any subsequent litigation. If, for example, a person opted not to accept the offer of settlement, the fact of this process, the amounts of the offer, those kind of things, similar to Rule 608 and the Rules of Civil Procedure, would not be admissible in court or legal proceedings subsequent to that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Just on the issue of no admission of liability, I looked at that part, and I went back, and I keep reading and rereading the legislative findings, and normally we try to avoid legislative findings. Sometimes there's the special circumstances. We'll have them into it if we feel a need to explain the bill. This might be an appropriate time for legislative findings. However, sometimes people read more into legislative findings than was ever intended, and perhaps we ought to just be cognizant of what is in findings and make sure that somebody doesn't suggest that the things that the legislature found is somehow an admission of liability. I mean, we can say in one place that it's not, and another place we sort of set up the stage where it is admission of liability. So I don't know how critical the findings are to the rest of your bill, but as I say, we don't want to have an unintended consequence here.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
Senator Betzel, I wholly agree with you, and we spent a lot of time trying to craft findings that we felt were appropriate to the circumstance. It was not the intent in the findings or anywhere else in the bill to say anything that would appear to be an admission of liability on the part of the state. And if there's any particular language that you think opens that door, I'd certainly like to know what you're referring to.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Latz, I've read it over a couple of times with this section in mind, and I don't see anything, but on the other hand, some creative minds might find something that, you know, I'm not seeing right here. So I'm just pointing that out, that we don't want the findings to come back and snap back at us.
Senator Betzel and Senator Latz, perhaps an insertion of a statement in the findings sections that says these findings does not constitute an admission of liability or something like that might be helpful to make it clear if Senator Betzel has raised that caution. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I'm particularly looking at Section B of the findings, and I think that the language in there could point out an opening for somebody to go after the state, actually. You know, the words like inappropriate and undue limits and those kinds of things, I think might wave a red flag towards somebody.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
On that point, Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, I'll remind the panel that the author's amendment deleted lines 2.27, starting with the word in addition through the end of that paragraph.
Yes. Okay. All right. Sorry.
Senator Latz,
but I still
think,
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins?
I still think a sentence that says legal claims of this nature are too complex, uncertain, time-consuming, and expensive for all parties involved is, I don't know that we want that in the law.
Well, I've asked counsel to perhaps, for our contemplation, create a small D with some language, kind of concluding the findings section about liability, admission of liability.
Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins?
I guess I'm becoming a Betzold Ophile. I think we ought to just delete the findings.
Well, Senator Higgins, when Senate Counsel and I met to talk about this bill, like we usually do before we came to the committee, there was a big X in that section from me.
And becoming a Betzold Ophile, isn't it?
And but Senate Counsel explained that many people worked hard to try to put together this findings section. And although the findings, as Senator Betzel has stated, is unusual, that in this particular case, given how we're crafting this particular mechanism to address this, that we might want to set the context for why we're doing this. And so, I couldn't erase the pen mark of the X, but I wanted to let the committee as a whole have an opportunity to look at it. And I didn't, talk to Senator Latz about it because I really took into consideration Senate Counsel's comments about how this is a particular case and it's unique, and we might want to set some context for it. So I'm not telling you that we shouldn't exit. I'm just sharing with you that was my instinct, but I was persuaded by the argument that this is a unique situation.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair. In particular, I don't care for line 2.26 and 2.7, saying legal claims of this nature are too complex, uncertain, time-consuming, and expensive. That's an incredible statement to be in law, I think. Mm. I mean, all by itself, I mean, I don't think very many people would agree with that.
Senator Scheid, would you like to move to strike that sentence?
Madam Chair.
Strike all of B.
Madam Chair, I would like to move to strike all of Section B, the B parentheses, lines 2.23 through 2.30. Well, through the 2.27, because he's already taken the last sentence out with his author's amendment. So it would be I would move to delete lines 2.23
the rest of
to
B.
The 2.27 period.
Well, the whole damn paragraph.
But we've already taken that out.
Correct. Discussions on Senator Scheid's amendment.
The rest of the paragraph.
Discussion. Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I suppose the more cautious way to approach it would be simply not to make any findings, and then if a court were to review it, they will simply take into account the entire legislative record, including all the comments made here today. There were some specific reasons for including these provisions. Since we are pulling this process out of the normal tort claims process and setting up a special system, a special no-fault system, these findings were intended to explain the purpose for taking that approach.
Madam Chair.
I'll leave it to the committee as to whether, in the end, you think that's the most appropriate approach.
Very good. Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I understand why you might want something there, but I believe also that the bill allows people to use the tort system and not participate in this if that's their choice, right?
Yes, Madam Chair.
So that would seem to be in conflict with, because we're telling them it's too time-consuming and too expensive, et cetera.
Scourging.
And then saying, but you don't, you can do that anyway. And so I really.
We're still on Senator Scheid's motion to strike. Yes. So Senator Olson, do you want to speak on the motion, or are you on to something else? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In respect to your motion, I think the word that bothers me the most is the word too.
T-O-O.
Because I have seen these kinds of things explain why we're doing things when we say it's because they're complex, they're uncertain, they're time-consuming. So that does give a rationale for doing this. But the word too, in comparison to what? I mean, that's almost like saying it's too difficult to bother. So, and some people may want to go through a different route. So.
And
so
that's not our intent here.
Right.
I mean, for the record.
Right.
Right. I mean, that's not, we're not saying that it's too much compared to something because we're dedicating all this time to the issue because it's important and critical to the state.
So, Madam Chair, I guess for me, I would be much more comfortable with this because recognizing that, yes, it's complex, it's uncertain, it's all of those things, but it's not to that. I mean, and so to me, that's the problem with this is that word T-O-O, and I would feel more comfortable with it if we just eliminated that word.
But Senator Olson, Senator Scheid's amendment is on the table to eliminate that entire section. So are you asking Senator Scheid to amend her amendment?
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, I guess I'm just I'm pointing out what bothers me about it for her consideration, but I don't want to, whatever she wants to do with her motion.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I agree. I think it is the word too that makes it sound patronizing or something. I mean, it's, but I also don't like, in this catastrophe, leaving victims the sole option of pursuing relief through the courts. I understand why that. I don't understand why that may not necessarily be in the best interest of the state or the victims, but I think it's a very strange sentence. Hmm. And with humble apology to whoever wrote it or made it, but I don't think it belongs there. So, I'll be glad to, we'll just deal with the word too, and I'll look at this some more. So I accept what Senator
the friendly Olson amendment,
yeah,
Senator Scheid.
So we'll just be eliminating on line 2.262.
Senator Higgins.
This is just near and dear to my editor heart, you guys. This is great fun. I still think that if we eliminated Section B and then changed the beginning of Section C to the establishment of a specific compensation process for victims furthers the public interest, blah, blah. We wouldn't have to say all the things that are in Section B about, you know, complex. Yeah, the evils of a lawsuit.
Senator Scheid withdraws her motion. Now let's have the conversation from the beginning.
So, Madam Chair, I think that we would be best by eliminating Section B and then making that small change at the beginning of Section C, the establishment of a specific compensation process for the victims of the bridge collapse, blah, blah, and then continuing on might be a good way to kind of craft a better statement of findings without the things that we objected to.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Higgins, in large part, I agree with you. If I put that in context with this next paragraph, I wasn't thinking about that. But I'm overhearing some of the remarks the council is making, and I was thinking the same thing, that the word specific doesn't really fit. Something like special compensation process
special
would probably...
New.
Well,
different.
The establishment of a compensation process.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's deal with paragraph B first, members. Okay. So we've gone back and forth. Senator Scheid has withdrawn her motion. Senator Scheid, would you like to
Well, Madam Chair, it sounds like Senator Higgins remakes my
statement.
Senator Higgins moved that Section B on page 2 from lines 2.23 through to the end of Section B be stricken and the paragraphs be reordered. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Now Senator Olson moves that on line 2.31 the word alternative be deleted.
And an alternative.
An alternative. The words and alternative be deleted. Any discussion?
And the word A.
Substitute A.
The word A.
And insert A.
Have a conversation.
All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Do we still need a subsection D to explicitly state that this is the finding section is not an admission of liability?
That's up to you, lawyer.
As I had suggested earlier.
She is asking whether we need a new sentence. I thought it said
that
somewhere
else. Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
I'm the one who raised the initial concern. You know, when we talk about the legislature finds that this was a catastrophe of historic proportions, well, bridges normally don't fall down. This was the third busiest bridge in the state. It killed 13 people, injured more than 100. No other state-owned structure has ever fallen with such desert. I mean, these sound like somebody ought to be liable. And so I think that maybe... You know, I mean, we can disclaim liability in another part, and this is not codified, proposed to be codified, but I think if you say it twice, this does not constitute admission of liability, I think that brings the point home, if we're going to have findings at all.
Senate Counsel, can you read to us a suggested language for a small D, a small C?
Madam Chair and members, there's a couple of alternatives. You could say these findings must not be construed as an admission of liability of the state for damages caused by the bridge collapse, or these findings are not an admission of liability.
How about these findings are not an admission of liability?
Madam Chair, could you repeat that, please?
Yes. Can you insert the suggested language?
Madam Chair, members, there would be a new paragraph. These findings either must not be construed as or are not an admission of liability of the state for damages caused by the bridge collapse.
Madam Chair, just,
Senator Betzel.
I think the more directly you can say it, the better. It's not a... Which would be the second version.
All right. Senator Betzel moves.
Yeah, I'll move it.
The insertion of the following language.
Oh, Madam Chair, members, that would be on page 2 after line 34 and insert what will now be paragraph C. These findings are not an admission of liability of the state for damages caused by the bridge collapse.
Any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Gosh. Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
While we're still on the topic of findings, might I offer a small suggestion on line 2.33, or whatever it will turn out to be after it's renumbered. After the word uncertainty, insert and expense.
I'll move it.
And expense. Senator Betzel moves that on line, on this page, 2.33, after uncertainty, insert and expense. Any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Going back to paragraph F on the next page, I think we've come up with a kind of an easy fix for the language there. That paragraph all becomes one sentence, and it would say victim means parentheses one, a natural person who was present at the I-35 bridge at the time of the collapse, comma, parentheses two, parens, the parent or guardian, da-da-da-da-da, years of age, comma, parens three, parens, a legally appointed representative of a victim
comma, or for the surviving spouse. So it would just make a numbered series there.
Good idea.
And I think that fixes it.
Senator Higgins, repeat it one more time
okay.
So that all the members have it.
I'll do it the traditional way now. On line 3.10, after the word means, insert parentheses, the numeral 1 parentheses. Line 3.11, after the word collapse, change the semicolon to a comma. Delete victim includes, insert parens, numeral 2 parens. Line 3.12, after the word age, change the semicolon to a comma. Insert parens, numeral 3 parens. After the word victim, change the semicolon to a comma. After the word or, insert parens, numeral 4 parens.
Senator Higgins, move those changes as she stated. Any discussions? Senator Betzel.
And just a technical question for Ms. Pontius. Is that stylistically how the reviser would do it with commas as opposed to semicolons, or how does the style normally work?
Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, I think normally we'd use semicolons instead of commas in there to just kind of break apart the clauses.
It's just a plain old series with no internal punctuation.
But stylistically...
Grammatically,
we will give counsel the latitude to conform it to what the revisers would like the form to be, in terms of whether we use a comma or a semicolon. And Senator Higgins will incorporate that into her amendment.
Against my own better judgment.
Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Higgins.
Chair, I have several other places where semicolons should be commas.
But stylistically, Senator Higgins?
It's not stylistically. Oh. If you go down to 3.16 and 17.
Senator Higgins?
Yeah, to consider claims, comma, make offers, comma, and enter into. It's just a plain old series. And there's no reviser's way to change a series to anything other than comma, comma, comma. Unless there are internal commas.
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, I think there's a number of places in statute that really don't follow grammatical rules.
Right, and but we could start.
And for a reason. I mean, you'll see court cases where they argue about where the commas are in a sentence and how what it means. So we usually try to the extent we can kind of separate off discrete clauses with semicolons, that's the way it's normally drafted that way.
Exactly. But these are not clauses. This is just items in a simple series. This would be the same as saying, in my basket is an apple, a pear, and an orange. It's no different a construction in these sentences. The same thing happens in 3.29 and 3.0. The same thing happens in 4.5. Same thing happens several other places. They're just plain series. They're not clauses. I'd give you the clauses if they were clauses, but they're not.
Senator Higgins, would you like to identify those places? And I believe they're all over the bill. So
well, they're all kind of here in a chunk. 3.16 and 1.7, those commas should be semicolons. 3.29 and 3.0. Those semicolons should be commas. 4.5, those semicolons should be commas. And I'll stop there.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, there is a specific book that the revisers does put out on style and so forth. And I think Ms. Pontius's counsel is, I think, really ought to be taken into consideration because statutes don't always read well, and but legally there's a reason why they have to be written kind of the style that they are. It doesn't mean that you can't write statutes better, but I would go cautiously at this point because I do know that there is a particular format that must be followed in writing statutes.
Senator Latz, you might think that members of this committee are nitpicky, but I have to tell you that we take our work very seriously. That's why we're even arguing about commas and semicolons for the members of the public who are here. Senator Higgins, we'll take your suggestions under consideration.
Okay. And I think if you look in the revisor's book, you'll see they should be commas.
We'll take it under consideration. Thank you, Senator Higgins. We appreciate your editorial skills on this committee very much.
I can't bring any lawyer skills, Madam Chair. I can only
Senator
bring
Olson.
Editor skills.
And then I think Senator Olson, do you have a point?
Well, I have a concern about the issue that Senator Latz talked about when he talked about trying to deal with third-party subrogation or recovery, especially with respect to ERISA. And I'm not sure if we're changing gears now or if it's appropriate to bring that up at this point or even if he's finished walking us through that part of the bill.
Let's get through to the end. Will you hang on to that? Because
okay.
I know Senator Foley has some things he's been waiting very patiently to talk to us about.
Okay.
Because that's a broader issue. Senator Latz, are we at the end?
Almost.
All right. I think we're on page 6. Subdivision 3, payments from other sources.
Madam Chair, I don't know if we got to subdivision 2 on page 5. There was the author's amendment did delete some words on line 5.34 under section 1 and from the emergency relief fund was deleted there in the author's amendment. That subdivision is intended to indicate that payments from this fund would be supplemental to or in addition to payments made by any third party under law or contract, and that these payments are not a collateral source for purposes of the other applicable Minnesota statutes or other laws for the reduction of a damage award recoverable by a victim from a third party. And this is an attempt by the state to indicate that payments that are made here through this fund are not to be deducted or recaptured by other third-party payers to the victims. Subdivision 3
hit the highlights as we're going down. Yes. Senator Latz.
Well, all of these provisions in here basically try to protect the victim as much as possible from being subject to recovery of the funds that the state pays to them from various sources and to protect the rights of the state to seek its appropriate recovery from any third-party tortfeasors.
Very good. Thank you. Just to confirm, members, we did adopt Senator Higgins' motion to rewrite the victim's definition, correct?
Mm-hmm.
We did, right? So let the record reflect that we did do that. I thought we did that. But. All right. Senator Foley, you've been waiting patiently until we get to page 6.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move to strike on line 6.3. The words, notwithstanding any statutory or common law or agreement to the contrary, comma, and make appropriate connections on that with A, I assume, as cap rather than, and do the same thing on line 6.9 and 6.10, and also on 6.15 and 6.6, and on lines 6.19 out to the words, the state, and put a capital letter 2 in there and rather than the lowercase. All of which are redundant, Madam Corrector.
Discussion, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Foley. I'm not sure. I'm not sure I agree with you, because without those phrases as an introduction, we're going to have statements that are going to be in contradiction to other laws that we have on the books. And even though this is specific and it's dealing with a situation where we're usually, if it's, I think the general rule is if you're dealing with something that's more specific, that takes priority over a more general rule. I still think that there's a conflict. And honestly, I have a lot of concerns about, in fact, my understanding of ERISA law is that it's governed by federal law, which is going to preempt anything that we put to this effect in statute. And I don't have any confidence in the insurance industry's concern about doing the right thing as far as publicity and so forth, and not asserting their subrogation rights for those reasons, because I've been down that road and I've made that argument many times on behalf of clients, and typically what you get back is something along the lines that we have obligations to our shareholders or our stockholders or our other employees, and we don't have the authority to make that determination, and someone passes the buck, and it's just a real problem. And I think it's really unfortunate and a tragedy that it took this bridge collapse to really highlight this issue in the minds of so many people, so that they really finally understand what that federal preemption and what ERISA does.
Senator Olson, I really don't see where that has anything to do with deleting the language that I asked to be deleted.
Well,
that all is redundant. It isn't necessary. You're repeating the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chair,
Senator Betzel.
And this is probably appropriate for counsel, but as I recall, we have laws on statutory construction, and as Senator Olson said, a specific would be considered as opposed to a general statute. Also, a later statute would be considered that we pass that with knowledge of what the earlier statutes already on the books, so you don't necessarily need to say not with any statute or common law to the contrary, because presumably we've considered that, and by passing this, we're basically saying whatever was done before doesn't apply to this situation. I think that's my explanation for it, but maybe Ms. Pontius can explain how the courts would view it if we did not have this particular language here.
Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, I think you're correct in that. Usually when I'm drafting, I try to avoid these sort of blanket notwithstanding clauses. Usually if you know that there is really a specific statute that is in conflict with what you're doing, then you want to specifically refer to that statute, say notwithstanding section blank, blank, blank. I think sometimes these are used just because there may be so many different contrary laws that this is intended to sort of pick everything up. Not just statutes, but also, common law. There are some court cases that, maybe have had rulings that would be contrary to what's being expressed here. I would think a court would still look at this language as speaking for itself, but it's intended, just to really emphasize that this is what the rule is, no matter what any other law says. So it's your call as to whether to put it in or take it out or leave it in.
On Senator Foley's motion, any further discussions? Senator Foley, would you like to repeat the specific motion? Why don't, or should we have counsel read through to make sure we catch all of them?
I would think it would be nice to have counsel do that.
Let's have counsel read through. Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair, members, it'd be on page 6, basically the same language that appears on lines 6.3 and 6.4. 6.9 and 6.10, 6.4
15 and 16 and 6.19 and 20, just take out the lead-in clause, notwithstanding any statutory common law to the contrary, comma.
On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no.
No.
Motion prevails. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, what I was starting to try to get to, and I probably just didn't get there fast enough, but in relation to what Senator Foley was saying is, I just wonder whether Senator Latz has considered another approach to this. Based on my experience, what you need in a situation like this in dealing with the ERISA carriers is some kind of leverage. And if they have you over a barrel because there's their law at the federal level preempts what we say, what we're saying here in state law, and they know that the money is coming and that they're going to get it, you don't have a lot of leverage. I wonder whether it would be possible to say, basically, to put some language in here that says if they're going to take it, the money isn't coming, period. That way, it might give the victims some leverage to bargain with these companies to say, well, if you're going to assert all of your if you're going to assert this right, you're not going to get anything. So maybe if you take 10%, that's better than nothing, and we get 90%. And that might be better than putting the victims in the position where we've tried to protect them, but the protection is meaningless, and then the ERISA companies end up taking everything. So I just wonder if there's a way to draft, if that would be something we could really do effectively that would put the victims in a better position than what we're trying to do if it's not enforceable.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I'm open to any suggestions that we think would strengthen the position. It is the goal, it is my goal as the author of the bill, to use Minnesota taxpayer dollars to compensate victims for their losses, not to reimburse ERISA covered payments. That said, you know, we could put some language like that in there. This is an issue which is faced by everyone who makes a tort claim against the state. It's not unique to claims arising out of the bridge collapse. But to the extent that we can strengthen the hand of the victims in dealing with that, you know, I think that's helpful. Whether or not we want to mandate that, and we could put a provision in that we'll release the money once the victims have a written statement from the ERISA plan that they will not seek, or they will only seek up to X percentage of the money that's being released. Whether we want to put that in, you know, is a different question.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, excuse me. I think it's like 60% of Minnesotans are in ERISA plans of the people who have the insurance. And so one can kind of apply that number, you know, to the bridge victims. This is exactly the subject area that Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee will be dealing with. And I like the direction that Senator Olson's going, and I strongly support doing that, and I want us to maybe work on language between now and then. I think we're hoping that this will be there Thursday if we pass this bill. Mm-hmm. So I think we could do that work there. Mm-hmm. But I like having the discussion here, obviously. You know, it may help us mm-hmm. get there. I don't know if you have something for right now tonight. But
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, mm-hmm. I just wanted to raise that for Senator Latz's consideration. Yes. And I think, perhaps I'm assuming Senator Latz has had conversations with people, representatives on behalf of the victims and working out the language of this bill. I guess I don't know what they might suggest or if they think something like this would be helpful, but I'd be interested in any suggestions like that that would help to strengthen the position they'll be in dealing with this issue.
Senator Higgins?
It's not on this subject, so... If people are
any further discussions on this point?
Senator Higgins.
Okay. I have a couple of questions. I think I'll just leave one off. And the other one I don't quite know how to ask, and I don't quite know. I guess I'll just throw it out there, and I suspect Senator Latz might know. Do most people have a cap on their medical benefits on their insurance, like a lifetime cap or a lifetime through the time that you hold the policy?
So
I believe so. Is that
Senator
right?
Latz?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, I believe the answer to that is yes.
Okay. I will make the assumption that some of the folks who were on the bridge and had serious injuries may reach that cap. And so I'm wondering if there would be a way for us to either allow an exception to the cap or some mechanism like that. Because I can't imagine anything worse than, you know, hitting that lifetime benefit and then realizing, you know, you're out of health care. I mean, I don't know how you do that, because many of the folks, you know, were young people on that bridge. The second piece to that then would be if we could come up with some sort of an arrangement that could help the victims with that piece of it. There also are, you know, all of the first responders who were at the bridge. And, you know, I'm very happy that there were there were no serious injuries to any of the first responders, but I believe that they probably went to counseling. You know, they would have some grief issues. They would have some claims against their health insurance also. And so I'm wondering if it would be appropriate for us to make some sort of an arrangement to help them if in some circumstances, you know, the claims that they would make against their insurance companies would, you know, move them toward their caps as well. And I don't have any idea if this is possible or whether I'm way out in left field, but it's just something that I thought about.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I think you do face the ERISA issue again, but there is, I don't know if you'd call it precedent because it's a state plan, but we did just lift the lifetime limit on MCHA patients because we have a couple of people in the state who've reached the limit, and I think we took it now up to $5 million. And I'm not sure exactly where it was before, but
probably
we did do that, I think, this last year. And so, I mean, I don't think we can just arbitrarily do that to existing, you know, private contracts, but I think we should consider, you know, I don't know if it's another fund. I don't know what it is, but I think it's a valid point. I mean, I think we've seen that issue arise, like I said, in the MCHA setting, which is a state plan, but we may be able to have do something in terms of a fund.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to say to, first of all, to Senator Higgins, I think with respect to first responders, I would think that if they had claims, medical claims related to the work they did, that would probably be covered by our workers' compensation system because it would be a work-related claim. So I would think they would have indefinite medical care for that. I would think. I mean, I'm not sure unless it's something that workers' comp didn't cover. But with respect to other people, I think Senator Scheid is right. I think in general we can say that the type of insurance offered for a certain category, we can change the rules, but I don't think we can go back with respect to a particular thing and if there's a contract in place where we can interfere with the terms of that contract kind of retrospectively. I'm not sure how we would do that.
At a bothered me, so I thought I'd bring
it up. Yeah, I think Senator Scheid is right, though, that that's kind of a separate issue and you're, you know, another issue to be dealt with.
Any further discussions on the bill and the different pieces of the bill? Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, and Senator Lass, maybe I'd like to go back to this date of enactment issue. Maybe we can just put a placeholder in here. This was, I think, page 4, line 4. Realistically, when do you think that we would be able to pass the bill as you see it now, maybe get a bill through conference committee, get it presented to the governor, get it signed, and then it'll be 6 months after that that the claims would have to be filed? What do you think would be a realistic time frame?
Senator
and
Lass.
Again, we can change this. We can, this will change, but I'm thinking we should just put a placeholder in here right now so we don't forget about it.
Senator Lass.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold. The timeline contemplated by the legislative leadership was to have it out of standing committees and off the floor of each House by February 28th, and then to have it through with conference committee and back off the floors of each House before spring recess, which would be around March 19th, I think, or 20th, something like
so.
That. The hang-up, as I see it right now, potentially is how long it will take for the Department of Finance to get the fiscal note to us. We're not going to be in a position to go before the Senate Finance Committee if we don't have a fiscal note. Right now, we're on their calendar for February 27th. But I don't know if we can get the fiscal note by then. So there might be some slippage in there. And then I couldn't predict for you exactly how long conference committee will take. There's a fair amount of overlap between what I understand is proceeding in the House and what's in this bill. But there are some key differences in concepts, specifically retaining the individual cap in there. And I'm not sure how we're going to be able to resolve that at this point.
Madam Chair.
If we were to say, anticipating perhaps we'd have something to the governor by April 1st, I don't think that's unrealistic. I think that's a fair goal.
So Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Senator Lass, 6 months after that would be October 1st, right? That would be about the time. If rather than saying 6 days after the date of enactment,
right.
October 1st, and that I double checked to make sure that doesn't fall on a weekend. That's a Wednesday in 2008. So maybe, Madam Chair, I could just suggest, again, as a placeholder, on page 4, line 8, instead of must file a claim within 6 months after the date of the enactment of the section, change that to file a claim with this panel by October 1, 2008. And that date will undoubtedly change many times over the next few weeks, but let's just keep the concept there.
And then don't you want the next...
Discussions on...
No,
Senator Betzel, are you making that a motion?
Yes.
1 year after that is 1 year after the vote. Yes, and you may as well put April 1st or May 1st or something in the second sentence.
Well, let's deal with that one first, and then Senator Higgins is calling my attention to another one, so I'll move that part first.
So repeat that. Senator Betzel moves that.
On page 4, line 8, right. Change within 6 months after the effective date to by October 1, 2008.
Any further discussions on that amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Betzel.
And Madam Chair, then on 4.9, the very next sentence, it says any offer made must be made by the panel within 1 year after the effective date of the section, which also adds to the confusion. And perhaps we could just say by October, or no, it's 1 year after the effective date. So, that would be 6 months. Okay, August. April 1, 2009. Is that's consistent with what you're looking for, Senator Lass? Is that correct? About that. Okay,
yes.
April 1, 2009.
So Senator Betzel moves that on line 4.9 after the word by, delete to the end of the period and insert April 9?
April 1.
April 1.
2009.
Any further discussions?
I don't know what date that falls on. Let's.
That will be a week.
All those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 All those opposed say no. The motion prevails. Any other discussions on the bill?
I've got one or two questions.
Senator Betzel.
Senator Lass, you did mention in your opening remarks something about how we were going to exempt out the University of Minnesota and the City of Minneapolis. Was that part of the bill here? I don't remember seeing any references or any statements in there on that.
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair and members, the definition of state that's used refers back to the State Tort Claims Act, and that includes the University of Minnesota.
Okay.
And then same municipalities are included in the releases, and that includes pretty much every other government entity. So.
And then, Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel,
you did mention you've talked to the Chief Justice, and I know we can't ask the judicial branch to discuss things that might come before them. However, it is possible that if the Chief Justice becomes involved in appointing this panel, there may be lawsuits brought that might wind up going to the Supreme Court. Does the Chief Justice see a personal conflict in involving himself in this panel, this compensation panel, and also hearing the cases? I'm sure he could recuse himself if it came to that point, but I don't know if that issue came up in your discussions with the Chief Justice.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I think it's fair to say the Chief Justice is aware of that potential issue and has not indicated to me that he is not willing to play the role contemplated in this bill.
Thank you.
Very good. Any other?
Oh, and Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel.
I want to just comment, Senator Latz, in your remarks, I think you had talked about the fact that over the meetings you had over the summer, there's some discussion, and apparently the other body is looking at having some sort of a permanent fund. And I think that within the Senate, I like your approach, you know, just let us deal with the tragedy that we had and try to find some way to address the needs of the victims here. I think if we've been told a year ago right now there's going to be a horrendous tragedy, Minnesotans are going to die, many people are going to be injured, but I won't tell you what it is, something's going to happen. I don't know if we would have known how to construct a compensation fund. And just as we are trying to address what happened last August 1st, I don't know if we can figure out what's going to happen with another tragedy if we're so unfortunate to have another one. So I think we ought to just stay with what we're at, as you're proposing to do. Let's address this situation, hope there's never another one. And maybe if there is another one, if there's any shortcomings in this one, maybe they'll have learned from this and they will, you know, be able to build on what we did here. So I commend you for trying to focus it where I think the real need is.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I wonder, and here again, something I don't know anything about, I'm just questioning, is this the kind of legislation that we should put a sunset on?
A sunset.
Well, it's kind of guided by
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, members, it'll be uncodified, so it won't be in the statute books, and they won't be funded.
So then by virtue of having no more funds, then it has no more effect, Madam Chair?
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, yes, and I think also by putting the deadlines in there as far as when claims can be filed and processed. Mm-hmm. I mean, theoretically, I suppose the next session the legislature could look at this and say this just wasn't enough time. As of right now, the appropriation for the administration expenses is just good until July 1, 2009 in the bill. So.
Okay.
Good. I know that there are no more questions from the committee, and we're ready to move the bill. But if the members of the committee, we have been here all night, if you would indulge me a little bit. Mm-hmm. We have in the audience victim and victim families who are here tonight. And so we'd like to give you, you know, the next 10 minutes to come up and share your thoughts or speak on the issue to this committee if you would like that opportunity to do so. I don't have any names that have been submitted, so please clearly identify yourself for the record so that we may know who you are.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Chris Messerly, M-E-S-S-E-R-L-Y, and for the last 27 years I've been with the Robbins firm. I am leading, along with my firm leading, a group of 20 law firms across the state providing pro bono services to victims of this tragedy. I'm speaking on behalf of more than 95 of those who are on the bridge. And thank you kindly for this opportunity. We will be brief, only two witnesses, well, a couple and one other witness. I'd just like to introduce Brad and Paula Coulter, C-O-U-L-T-E-R, and ask if they could just say a few words, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Coulter and Ms. Coulter.
Thank you. Paula and myself and my two daughters were on the north end of the bridge when it fell. We fell about 65 feet, landed on the roof. We all sustained back injuries. I was taken to North Memorial, and my two daughters and my wife were taken to HCMC. Myself and my two daughters were in back braces for 3 months. Paula, upon reaching HCMC, was taken directly to surgery. She had a traumatic brain injury, and she had shattered one of her vertebrae in her back. So she spent a month in ICU. She spent a month at NAP rehab at HCMC, and then she spent a month and a half at Kurtz Center in Golden Valley. So she joined us at home December 14th. So we're happy to have her home.
Ms. Coulter, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I guess I don't have any more to add to Brad. I wish we wouldn't have been on the bridge that day. I wish the bridge wouldn't have fallen. But we're dealing with what we have to deal with, and I hope that we can get support.
Given what you two have gone through, we are all very glad to see you sitting in this room today. Very glad. Thank you for coming and making the time.
Madam Chair, the only other person that of the clients we represent that I'd ask say something is Jennifer Holm.
Jennifer
Holmes, H-O-L-M-E-S.
Ms. Holmes, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you for also considering to help us with this fund. My husband, Pat, was on the bridge, the car behind the Coulters, and he wasn't so fortunate. His car went backwards, and a big overhead sign came down and crashed on his car and crushed him. I've been basically left to raise two young children by myself. They're 5 and 7 now. They both had their birthdays since August. So, basically what I'm facing is raising these two little kids by myself without his help, without his income. His income, you know, would be well over $1 million, you know, all said and done. And the other thing that's hurting me, he provided the health insurance, and I had to pick that up through work. And by me picking up family health insurance, my paychecks went $400 less. And that's just every paycheck, so it's $800 a month. And, I mean, that's just what I pay in daycare a month. So it's a huge hit, you know, and many, many things besides financially, you know, the help he did around the house. Thankfully, I've had a lot of people helping and supporting, but, you know, it's just, it's been hard, and it's something that we're going to have to face for a long time. And so I guess what I would also like for you to consider, and I know it was kind of brought up a little bit, but I know with the cap and everything, but if you got rid of the cap and pooled maybe that cap money into a pool and then divvied it up according to what people needed, because there are some people that don't need that much, but there's others like the Coulters and Mercedes and a ton of other people who are facing much more than that $400,000. And so if it could be split up differently so that the people who really need help can get it, so they're not facing bankruptcy. Thank you.
Well, Ms. Holmes, thank you for coming to the committee tonight. And you know, I have young children, too. I have an 8-year-old who just turned 8 and a 4-year-old who will be turning 5. And I have a 1.5-year-old, so I know what it's like to have a young family. And it's going to take a lot of courage to move on. And we all understand that. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I should note, I had 3 constituents, you know, who died of the 13. And Mrs. Holmes' husband was one of them. Mrs. Sather, who's in the back there, her husband died. They'd been married for 10 months, when her husband died, and then I had a third constituent. And then actually I live right next to the New Brighton border, and there's a fourth one, one just from my immediate area, who died in that bridge collapse too. So I personally thank, you know, Mrs. Holmes and Mrs. Ather for coming and spending the night. I mean, this is, and they were overwatching the House proceedings as well too. This has been very difficult for them, but I thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, if I may.
Mr. Messley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, just a few words on behalf of all the victims. This truly is a unique event, as the Chair noted. It's not a natural disaster. It's nothing like Drew Shadeen, where some crazy and sick person kills a woman. There is no reasonable expectation of a recovery against any other parties. We've hired the best experts in the world, and there's no indication that there's any significant liability. There may be. And we do ask on behalf of all the victims that for the fundamental fairness and justice of this unique event, such that there's even a bill here to waive the cap, that the money be put into one fund so it can be fairly and justly distributed. If $400 for each person or even less than that was put into one fund, it would be much fairer for these people, because under the present proposal, and I want to say at the outset how grateful we are for all of this and for all the that everyone is doing here to help. This present proposal hurts only the most seriously harmed. Senator Higgins hit the nail on the head that people are going to hit the wall. Their medical expenses will not be paid. The Coulters are trying to pick right now. They only have 90 physical therapy visits. She's running out. She can't do occupational therapy. She can't do speech therapy because she has to save what little she has for physical therapy. And for those people that would be most harmed by this, they ask and beg and plead that that not happen, that there be justice for all in money putting in one fund like 9/11 so someone can decide where it goes. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Messley. And as the bill moves forward, you know that there are a number of committees that it has to travel through. And even though the Judiciary Committee has completed the work that we need to do to look at the legal instruments in this bill, certainly this bill will be traveling through. And I know Senator Latz feels very strongly about this issue. And so I know that many people will be given input. And we will certainly take your comments and your suggestions into consideration. Thank you for being here tonight.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Did you want to move the bill?
Yes.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, then I would like to move that Senate File 2824. As amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee.
Before we take that vote, Senator Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I respectfully ask that I be excused from voting.
Is that a motion?
No.
No? Let the record reflect that Senator Orman is excused from this vote. Any further discussions? On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Members, thank you so much. Senator Latz?
Sure. I didn't hear the exact terms of the motion, but we refer to commerce. Is that what the motion?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Members, thank you so much for staying late tonight. You've all done great work, and if we're going to stay late to do anything, this is the right issue for us to stay late for. So thank you all very much. The Senate Judiciary Committee is adjourned. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.